Good morning, everyone. You're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown. This is Seven Generations Radio, and I'm your host, Joe Gray. And this morning, we're going to be talking about substance abuse, addiction, treatment, and hopefully recovery. My guests today are Kevin Knowles, who is a councilman with the Martinsburg City Council. And he's been charged with developing plans for a facility for alcohol and drug abuse treatment in by the Berkeley County Commission. And also with me is family medical doctor John Aldis, who practices in the Shepherdstown area. And Zakima Gill is also here, who is a practicing psychiatrist, who also has a radio show called Are You Crazy? So welcome, and I'd like to start with Kevin Knowles. Kevin, let me just check your mic first, if you'd like to say hello.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing today?
That wasn't very loud. Let's try it again.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing today?
Okay. Kevin, I understand that you are charged with developing plans for a new treatment facility. Could you please fill us in on that, maybe talk a little bit about the need for the facility, what purpose it will serve, and maybe any thoughts about the facility itself?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that the position that I've taken on, the County Commission, County Council in Berkeley County has stepped forward and created a position called the Community Recovery Services Coordinator. And what that entails is not necessarily building a treatment facility, but to find all different types of aspects of treatment, detox, and recovery, and to bring the best options that we can come through investigating and personal knowledge to present to the County Commission, County Council, so that they can make an informed decision on which direction that they want to go with 750 Baltimore Street. But as you know, 750 Baltimore Street is a contentious item right now, because there's a lot of back and forth between city and county officials about the use of that facility. And at this point, it's going to be in the courts, and the courts will decide that one way or the other. But to my job, I started about 2 weeks ago, and I put together some goals and initiatives that will be presented to the county council here in the near future, and I'm working on a strategic plan for the position itself. In the meantime, I've been able to pull in a network of people that I've used for, coming up on 19 years, and since I've come to the Eastern Panhandle 12 years ago, I've been very involved in the recovery community and the recovery process, not only here locally, but on the state and on the national level. So these organizations, the people that I've been closely associated with over the years, are pretty much the people that I take kind of counsel from, and I've seen their work in action. I've seen their results, and their, they speak for themselves. And when I see people walking around half dead, and then, 6 months, a year later, that their lives have turned around, and they're working a program, some type of a program, and that shows me that people want recovery. Recovery's out there, and I myself, I'm in recovery over 18 years, and I'm very involved in the recovery community. I have a lot of experience in working with people, and people coming to me and coming to organizations that I deal with, and it's a great pleasure to be able to watch someone come out of that darkness and into a new way of life. And I know for me that if my community wasn't around and if they weren't doing things for me back 18 years ago up in Lackawanna County in Scranton, Pennsylvania, I wouldn't be sitting here today, because They had some things put together that we don't have here in West Virginia, that we don't have here in this county, or didn't have in this county. And the county council has decided that they're going to put it all on the table. And when they put it all on the table, they put it on my table. So now I got to sort through it and work through it and talk to people and see what are the best needs for this community. Not necessarily a one-facet type situation. I mean, there are some successful faith-based programs out there that I know of, and there's plenty of 12-step programs out there that are very, very successful also.
Could you talk a little bit about the problem that we're facing? What is it that we're up against?
Well, not only nationally, but locally. I can give you some numbers. Berkeley County, from January 18th to about the last week of February, we pulled some records. And there was a record of 90 overdoses. 66 of them were brought back through the Narcan, and 24 are dead.
Wow.
You run those numbers out, that's quite a big number for a year here in Berkeley County. So those people that are afraid of treatment facilities, thinking it's going to bring in a bad element, well, you know, it's already here, and nobody's working on it. And when you don't work on a problem, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and our job is to take that task and really dig into it and find the best possible way that we can address that. What that is, you know, we have our own thoughts, and you know, we're open to listen to other forms of recovery based options, but we have a process in our head that we're thinking about, and we're going to move on from there.
Okay. Let me switch to
Kevin. What was that time period again that you mentioned?
That was the January 18th, 2016, to about the last week of February. I will have better numbers, which I should say I'm going to have worse numbers, because I'm pulling numbers now. Since I've taken this position, I'm going to be requiring a lot of number bases from the counties. One of them is going to be for how much it's going to cost.
So we're talking about a six-week period?
Six-week period.
Where 90 people overdosed.
Overdosed in the county.
And 24 died.
24 dead, yes.
Those are huge numbers. How do you envision management between a police intervention and lockup versus using a treatment facility?
Well, there are programs out there. It's called a LEAD program, where we don't have in place at this point. It's something that we'll be presenting to the local law enforcement, where if somebody were to pick someone up, whether it be for prostitution or something petty or anything like that, that they would directly bring them to a place or a facility that we have for some counseling and everything, and then move on with the process. The whole idea of what the county is trying to put together is to alleviate or to reduce the cost of the jail, because there's so much cost going into our jail system right now on the county and on the city basis that we feel that if we address the recovery end of it and the treatment end of things instead of incarceration all the time, that we're going to see some huge successes. We base that on some things that are already in place. We have a day report center that was in Berkeley County and went to Jefferson County, and now is coming back to Berkeley County. So we're going to start seeing that happen here in Berkeley County again. But Jefferson County has found the reduction in their jail bill significantly because of the programs that Rhonda Eddy and the Day Report Center in Jefferson County has put together. So we want to be able to work with them very closely. And Ron and I, prior to me even taking this position, have worked closely on items. And I need to say that this is not something that I just jumped in 2 weeks ago. It's something that I've been working on since I moved here to the Eastern Panhandle 12, 13 years ago, that I've been working with the state and local officials in the background trying to find options for what we can do for our treatment of the addict. And this is where we're at today. So a lot of good things have happened to get there in that end, but unfortunately the bad stuff is people continue to die. And I tell people that although I am a city official, this is not about an election. This is about life or death for me. You know, if anybody cares to come after me, they're free to come after me. I'm still not going to stop what I'm doing. on this recovery and treatment aspect of it.
Okay. And Dr. Aldous, you are a practicing physician in this area. Could you kind of tell us a little bit about your experience in treatment and recovery for addiction programs?
Okay, well, I graduated about 45 years ago and spent almost all that time in family medicine, general practice, foreign service work, clinical research and vaccines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then several years ago, after I retired again from one of those jobs, I saw people dying around me and was up close with some of those people because they were working on my property, and I tried to get them treatment and simply could not find any place to get them treatment. Waiting lines of 6 months long for the medication-assisted treatment programs here, and there really weren't any options. And I figured, well, maybe one option is I could try to help out myself. So I got credentialed by the Data 2000 law, which allows me to prescribe medications for medication-assisted treatment. And now I'm working in a clinic as of about a year ago this month in Martinsburg, where we provide medication-assisted treatment. Now, just to be clear, medication-assisted treatment is not medication. The treatment is the counseling, which is required before we can give the medication and part of the process. It's challenging because the reimbursement process through Medicaid, sometimes private insurance, but not very often, is awkward and not very lucrative. And I'm not paid through that directly, but the clinic itself struggles a lot financially. But we've got some miraculous results and quite a few people. And people who have returned to jobs or they've gotten jobs for the first time in a long time. They're resolving their issues with the courts. We get referrals from, for instance, Day Report Center fairly regularly. They also are taking care of their families, and they claim their lives have been remade. The other side of that, though, is a six-month waiting line. The usual line to come into our clinic is a six-month waiting line, which is, of course, impossible. That's about as bad as anything can be to tell a sick person, okay, we'll take care of you in maybe 6 months if you're lucky. So, yeah, it's good and bad. It's been, in many ways, in the 45 years I've been working, in some ways, many ways, the most rewarding practice I've had in over that 45 years. Mm-hmm. But a lot of sad cases, too.
Yeah, and that, you know what, I'm sick and tired myself of hearing about waiting lines and no treatment here locally. I mean, over the years I'm here, there's hundreds of people that are dead that I've had conversations like we're having today and trying to find them help, and they're dead today. So the bottom line is we need to change these waiting lines and whatever we're doing, and we need to be able to supply those type of services that are out there. And you know what? It always comes down to money. And unfortunately, very unfortunately, that's always the bottom line. And I don't know about anybody else, but can't put a price on somebody's life and get somebody's life back together.
How will the facility be financed, and what kind of resources, human resources, do you envision having there to service people?
Well, we're not going into the treatment business, the county. The county is going to be a landlord. And all we're going to do is we're going to research and search out people and organizations that want to come to this area, that we can court to come to this area, and we will outfit whatever needs to be done for them to make that happen. We don't want to claim anything about knowing how to treat addiction. The reason why I'm here is just because of my background, but I have not treated addiction. You know, I've worked with it, but I have not treated it, and I rely on the people that are close to me in my network that have been with me for all these years to guide me in the right direction. And so far, you know, we're working for through that process. But again, I need to reiterate that the county is not getting into the treatment business. They are just facilitating a building for treatment to be allowed to be done.
So that means it's really open to different modalities of treatment, right?
This is correct. I mean, right now there's some places that we've looked at that they've looked at prior to me taking this position. There's a place in Virginia that I'm looking at. There's a place in Pennsylvania. There's a place in California. There's all these places. Everybody has great ideas for treatment. My whole thing is I want to see proof, and I don't mean proof on paper. I want to meet individuals that have successfully gone through programs other than what my experience has, and by meaning that I didn't go through a faith-based program, and I know people that are years in recovery, and those people will be part of a speakers bureau that I'm putting together. I don't know anybody that's been on Suboxone and methadone that have years of continuous better life because of it. I don't believe in Suboxone. I don't believe in methadone. That's just me personally. I don't believe it to be a lifelong process if it needs to be used for a period of time during a treatment process and have a weaning off process. I think that's the area that I'm open to, but anything that we're looking at for around here is definitely not anything that's going to be long-term as far as any medicated type treatment.
Well, these programs are known to have varying success rates and not tremendously great success rates. From my understanding, there's a lot of relapse in the process of recovery. Some people go through recovery programs five times before they succeed, and maybe others might not make it at all. So it kind of, to me, opens the door that maybe some things will work for some people and other approaches will work for others.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But again, we could talk all we want. We could put everything we want on the paper, but until we see actual physical people walking the streets and being able to tell that story for some length of a time. I can't tell you how many times people that will make that six-month period, no matter what program they're in. I can't tell you how many people make it a year, but very few make it 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years beyond that aren't working some type of recovery program. And those are the people that I need to talk to. If there's something out there that's working, and if it is something like Suboxone and methadone, and they have a 5-year history of it, they can prove to us that, physically prove to us that that's working, then hey, you know what, that could change my mind too. But I'm open-minded at this point, but I'm only open-minded to things that we know, and we know that work, and we've seen that works.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Aldis, have you seen, apparently you have seen this type of success with methadone treatment. Would you care to address that?
I don't work directly with methadone. There's only a few of those clinics in West Virginia, and there are not going to be any more of them. And our clinic does not, of course, dispense methadone. It's a fairly restricted process in West Virginia. there are actually a few people who are part of the clinical trials to see whether methadone worked or not 50 years ago who are still on methadone 50 years later. And people sometimes react with horror. Some of my own patients react with horror at that. Mm-hmm. They're not addicts anymore. They haven't relapsed in 50 years. They've continued with their family and their jobs. There are success stories like that out there. The difficulty is we often have a difficulty in thinking, why is that a success story? That's obviously a failure. No, to those individuals, it's a major success story, and we have to see it that way. Suboxone has a similar story, but Suboxone's got its problems, a lot of diversion, a lot of selling it on the street. That's a huge problem. If anything, maybe that's the biggest problem I have in my clinic. But I've got so many patients in the clinic. I can follow about 100 patients. I've got so many patients in the clinic who absolutely claim that their life was impossible before. I saw one patient a couple weeks ago who'd been to 10 rehab programs. 10. And I said, how long did you stay clean afterwards? He said, well, once I stayed 8 months. Now, mind you, he was sitting in front of me in the office, so those 10 hadn't done him a lot of long-term success at that point. And I said, okay, how many of those people offered any follow-up care after you left? The answer was zero. None. How long did you stay clean after those 9 other rehab programs? It was measured in hours or days after leaving the rehab program. So having a rehab program, and I'm sure Kevin agrees, is not the answer. Having something that makes some sense in the overall management of the patient's best interests, just detoxing them and putting them back on the street doesn't work very well, okay? And we having a place where, yes, you detox them. Yes, you do give them maybe some short-term rehab, but you make sure what happens to them after that. And you make sure that they are in a long-term recovery program. Yes, of course, 12 steps are fine. Celebrate Recovery is an excellent program. There are a bunch of programs out there, some of them more faith-based than others. Some of them, if you get a brief description of it, they'll say it's faith-based. But I talk to my patients who go there, and these are not particularly religious-oriented people. These are people who've never gone to church in the last 10 years, okay? They find them very, very supportive, very, very useful. And these are people who are on Suboxone, mind you, but they need that spiritual dimension in their recovery. And my clinic, unfortunately, doesn't offer that. So I encourage them to go to these programs. And they come back sometimes just breath taken away, how satisfying that is.
And I would agree that detox and treatment is not the end-all, final-all. We need to find, when somebody comes out of recovery, the arms that we're going to send them to, you know, mm-hmm. whether it be a faith-based, whether it be a 12-step oriented program, or in your case, if it needs to continue treatment down a Suboxone or methadone level. And that is the goal. The goal is not to be one facet. The goal is, one, let's get detox here, because there is none. You have to send them 4 or 5 hours away.
That's right.
There is no treatment around here. And if there is anything out there, there's a waiting list. And that waiting list, by that time, when you're talking to an addict, that's life and death. You know, not just, you know, let's not just talk about the addict, but let's talk about the family. You know, I lost my daughter for 18 years because of who I was when I was doing what I was doing. Mm. And I know the pain and the hurt that goes along with an addict that the family incurs. I come from a large Irish Catholic family, faith-based. And, you know, I was raised a Catholic, but, you know, I was raised a different Catholic than the faith that I believe in today, or how I look at my faith today. But I can tell you that that our goal as a county is to find what works for that person, you know, not just for the masses. We know that detox is a necessity. We know that treatment is a necessity. The things that we need to work on after that is, where are we going to have, what type of programs are going to be out there? I know that I'm constantly in treatment facilities that have me in a database and hundreds, maybe even thousands of people just like myself, that if someone's coming out of a treatment facility, there is a number that person has. And there is somebody that contacts me and says, hey, I got Johnny coming out, and he needs to get involved in some type of program. This is what we've been doing here, and you know, we have some 12-step, we have some faith-based. Can you help them out? And it's my responsibility, and I've jumped up as much as I can to be able to find that organization to get Johnny into. And you know what? It's successful. This is a treatment recovery, no matter what type of recovery you have, is not hugely successful. You know, it takes people time, more times than not, to go down the ladder, so to say, to do more damage to their lives and to themselves, to realize that, hey, enough is enough. And that's what it was for me. You know, enough was enough, and I needed to, step up and take some action. And I've been to two treatment facilities myself in my day, you know. And now my wife, she was a one-time wonder. She had enough. She went in. I have a younger brother that's 31 years in recovery, that's a doctor of addiction, and he's set up facilities throughout the United States and very involved in the recovery process. He was a one-time wonder. Well, you don't find that. That's very few and far between. The average number is 2, 3 to 5 rehabs before somebody gets it. The problem is, like the doctor said, you got to get the people to the right program when they come out. I learned about addiction. I learned about alcoholism in treatment. It was up to me to work on my recovery when I got out. And for me, it was a 12-step-based program, and that's where I jumped right in. And I just had to have blind faith. And you know what? It's worked for me, and it's worked for me very well, because I was pronounced dead twice and stabbed 3 times and shot twice while I was out there. I shouldn't be here today. I've been given a life beyond my wildest dreams. It's not only given back to the recovery community, but given back to the community that I didn't give back to all those years. You know, all I did was take. And that's a disease. The disease takes everything away. It took my dreams, my aspirations, ruined my family, ruined every relationship I had. But in the end, it came down to me wanting to get that back. And I work very hard today. I work every single day on my recovery. There's not a day that doesn't go by. Now, 99% of the time I'm working on my recovery, I could tell you that 1% when I don't, my mind gets crazy. I start thinking crazy things, possibly using again, you know, or doing something way out of the ordinary. But I have a support group that I can go to that can help me through that process.
I was talking with someone who had a little bit of experience with drug problems, and particularly with the youth. And I asked them, you know, what they thought was the best way to prevent kids from getting into this problem. And he said, close and continuing communication and contact with your children. And what you're saying is you need that close and continuing contact with the community once you come out of one of these programs if you're going to have any chance of succeeding.
What I'm saying is that I need to have that with the community and everybody around me, because it's a holistic effect for me. And I can tell you that education is one of the goals and incentives we're looking to put in place in Berkeley County. And I saw something interesting the other day that the state of Maryland did, and I think the lieutenant governor at the time, or right now, is spearheading that. But in Frederick County, in the school system, they had the kids from, I don't know what grades it was, but I think it was like first grade to high school, do projects based on addiction. And it brought them to a point where they would be surprised, the people at that age, and what they really seen and what they know about the drug epidemic here in the United States, and not specifically coming down that Route 70 and 81. And I'm going to have an opportunity to be part of a seminar with some of those people down at the Phoenix House out of Arlington. Is putting one on here at the 16th of March, I believe, in Arlington. And I'm going down. I want to hear some more about those education programs there.
At what age do addiction problems generally start, or is there some kind of a demographic that expresses that?
Well, I can tell you that my brother ran an adolescent. He was a clinical director for an adolescent program up in northeastern Pennsylvania, and they were pulling people from the inner city of New York and Baltimore and Philadelphia. And he said they were coming in at the ages of 10, 11 years old. That's how young it gets, especially when you get into the inner city. You know.
That's incredible. So
that's sad.
It sounds very important then to get, like you say, into the schools and for them to have some concept of the death rates that you gave us earlier. Those are staggering amounts of overdose and death in a short period of time. I don't know if young people have any clue that this is what's waiting for them when they, experiment with these things.
And you're right, but I think what I'm putting together is that there's going to be a weekly report and a monthly report that's going to have all those numbers together, and they're going to be real numbers because, you know, sometimes numbers can be skewed a little bit based on where they're coming from. But I'm also going to put a dollar sign on that, too. I mean, if you took an average call for an overdose, you're sending two EMTs with equipment, possibly a police officer, and possibly a fireman. So you're talking 4 to 5 personnel with full equipment, not to mention the Narcan that they need to. And I need to say, Doctor, thank you for what you're doing in that area. Yeah. I do have to say that that's a big help. And we're looking to possibly do some needle exchanging also here in the county. So there's some good things that are happening. It's just something that doesn't happen overnight. You know, people are talking treatment, treatment, treatment. Well, you know, I could find if I were to find a treatment option tomorrow, it would take a year, maybe two, to put it really in place. You know, I would think if we were going to build a building for it or outfit it. But we're going to do everything we can on the county level to facilitate and make that happen and have what we feel is the right type of programs to come here within Berkeley County. And this is not a one-man decision. There's a group that they're very well-informed and well-educated. Everybody has their own thoughts and their own ideas, and there's going to be a happy medium somewhere, I guarantee it.
You mentioned the Narcan, which, like you say, I've been working really hard on now for a number of months. It needs to be expanded, though. This is a take-home naloxone program, which individuals can take a short class. This is based on a law passed about a year ago by the state legislature. And then they can get a prescription, which I write for the naloxone, and then they take it home with them, and they leave it on their kitchen counter. Of the 5 cases, 5 lives we've saved so far, each one of those lives was because somebody knew it was on their kitchen counter. It was not the individual who took it off her kitchen counter and gave it to somebody. It was somebody else knew in the community. On NPR, driving home one day recently, I heard someone talking in Hagerstown, and their goal there was to inundate the community with naloxone. I think that's an incredible phrase. We need to inundate the community of Martinsburg with naloxone, okay? Take home naloxone, so it's there. It's one thing to say the ambulance can be there in 5 minutes, but that's 5 minutes of brain anoxia. That's 5 minutes of the brain not getting oxygen. Whereas if they can be given the naloxone at the start of that 5 minutes, call 911, which is part of the law. They have to call 911. When the ambulance does come, and the ambulance is still needed, that care is still needed, but hopefully the person will be breathing by that point, and that's the purpose of that. You also mentioned needle exchange. I was at the meeting last October that Dr. Deanna Gaviria, the medical officer for Berkeley County, held, and it was good meeting, a lot of support and a lot of favorable notions on it. We're a little bit behind the times here. We should have done this a long time ago. And she hasn't been able to make much progress. She's very disappointed at how difficult it is to move things forward. And, of course, I would like a needle exchange program here. But wait a minute. 63% of my patients have hepatitis C, okay, from dirty needles. And HIV is a problem. Hepatitis B is a problem. It's a big problem. So actually, my patients are hypersensitive to this because they're the ones who have 63% of them have hepatitis C. They're the ones who know the risk. They're the ones who know the dangers. They would like to be able to go to a pharmacy and buy needles and syringes. Not them, actually, because they're not currently using.
I hope not.
But other patients who are addicted. They would like to go to the pharmacies. Well, I went to the Board of Medicine when it met here in Martinsburg a couple months ago and clarified this point. Is there any pharmacy rule that says they can't sell the needles. No, there isn't. That's perfectly legal to sell the needles without a syringe, without a prescription. But it's very difficult for patients. And mind you, this doesn't take a grant. This doesn't take state funding. This doesn't take a federal money. This doesn't take money coming from the president. No. The patients who are going to be using the syringes are going to be paying for the syringes. And they're the ones who are trying to protect themselves. But it's one of the two pharmacies in the region, one of the two pharmacies has just been closed down. Unfortunately, it's kind of sad because they were actually very good about selling the needles and syringes. So there are ways to solve some things on a real small level, like my Narcan program and like the needles and syringes in the pharmacies. And these should be much, much broader.
And to a point you've made recently, John, a treatment of an uncomplicated case of hepatitis C is $150,000.
Mm. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. So to Kevin, your point about the cost of reviving someone with Narcan rather than, you know, having to call all the other procedures that are going to be needed once they get to the emergency room, you know, we're talking about huge sums of money that could be, you know,
utilized
cost, that, yeah, that could be utilized differently, that could be utilized for treatment. You know, I want to make two points. One is about holistic medicine, and one is about aftercare. You know, in the history of medicine, you know, if there's one thing we know, it's that a holistic approach is far superior to the magic pill. You know, we've never discovered a magic pill. For whatever disease process we've had to approach, it's always taken a holistic approach. The same is true of addiction. You know, psychiatry was having this debate a couple decades ago about medication versus therapy, psychotherapy, which is just a more sophisticated form of counseling. And we actually did studies where we had people that just received psychotherapy, and we had patients that just received medications, and study after study showed that when you combine the two, you got the best outcomes. It doesn't mean that some people can't recover from depression with psychotherapy alone. It doesn't mean that some people can't recover from depression with medication alone. But the vast majority of us need a combination of treatments. And it's so frustrating to me to hear that we're reinventing the wheel about this. I thought this was settled. The other thing is about aftercare. You know, I've been in both private practice treating people with addiction and people with psychiatric illness, and I've run units, dual diagnosis units for people with addiction and psychiatric illness. And time and time again, you know, aftercare is the key. When we have them in the hospital and we get them detoxed and provide the daily counseling and so forth, we get them cleaned up, okay? We get them halfway sane. Maybe they continue on the medicine, the substitute for their street drugs, or they're on psychiatric medications, or maybe they're not. Maybe by the time they're released from the hospital, they're off of all medications. But before they leave the hospital, they have an appointment the next day with a counselor or a case manager. And they have a program set up where they are connecting with someone related to their recovery program every day. You know, Kevin, you're in the recovery. How many 12-step programs are there in Martinsburg? Oh. Is there a program a day?
Oh, yeah.
Is there a meeting a day?
So if you know, without saying breaking any anonymity or anything, like, there's a building down on Martin Street,
okay,
in the middle of town.
Okay.
That anywhere between 50 to 150 recovering people,
mm-hmm,
are there for meetings.
Okay. Every day. Okay.
So they're out there, but again, it's anonymous. They come to the professional field. I'm sure you've had them come to your office and say, hey, this is stuff that we offer here. We have numbers that you can call when people come out. And you're absolutely right. That aftercare is the most important thing to have. The treatment facility they're talking about possibly down on Baltimore Street would have something like that set up. You would have a detox, long-term treatment. You would shorter, long-term inpatient treatment. You would have the day report center. You would have the probation. And then you would have the outpatient treatment. So the people that would be going there at first would be the ones that are facing the judges and the, mm-hmm. and the lawyers that are getting them in there. And mm-hmm. and there's going to be they need to follow that. Or their other option is, you know what, we're going to give you an 18-month program. We're going to give you 3 years in jail. Which do you want to try? And hopefully through that process, and like you're explaining the aftercare, you're going to see the recidivism. Drop
right, right. Yeah, but if you threaten them with 18 months, you know, a program, I mean,
it's a choice.
It's not a choice. Okay, and I get that. But, you know, whatever treatment we provide has to have the ability for that person with addiction to connect with someone therapeutic or a recovery program every single day. You know, we have in treatment what we call 90 and 90. When a person is, mm-hmm. when they're in the hospital getting detoxed and medicated and stabilized, they're seeing a counselor every day. They're in a 12-step meeting every day. They're meeting with a social worker every day, a family therapist. They're getting their lives together. And when before they leave, they sign a commitment to go to a meeting or see a therapist every single day, because relapse happens in a moment. Mm-hmm. You know, there are 24 hours in a day, you know. So that's all I really wanted to say.
Yeah, and I totally agree with what you're saying as far as the 90 and 90. And that it takes about 90 days for somebody to kind of get into some kind of routine and some kind of habit. And I always say it's like monkey see, monkey do for me today. You know, I do the same thing I did yesterday. Repeat, 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 and then I get the same results. Problem was is when I was growing up, I don't know about anybody else, but my parents would say, if you're going to hang around with people like that, you're going to turn out to be people like that, and I did. So today I hang around with people in recovery, and I received that recovery process. I listen to what they have to say. If I have problems and issues, even today, I run any major decision that I'm ready to make through some people that are in my recovery network. And based on what they tell me, although it's the most final decision is coming for me, I'm able to make a better decision. Every time I've made a decision based on that aftercare and recovery process and a network of people, even 18 years down the road, it's come out to benefit me 100% of the time. Every single time I've made a decision based on my own thoughts, my own emotions, and my own addictive thinking, it's come back to bite me in the proverbial arse.
Exactly. I hear you, Kev. And to that point, the other thing we do before patients are released from a program is they're connected with either a temporary sponsor in a recovery program.
That's key.
Or they have an emergency counseling number of someone that they can call in a moment's notice. Because we teach them that the impulse to pick up again will only last as long as the time it takes to dial a number. And being able to connect immediately with someone when you're having a severe craving or desire, you run into a buddy on the street who you've done drugs with, and all the cascade of fantasy comes back and the compulsion, you need someone that you can connect with that's just as far away as a phone call.
And you know what? That's part of what this position will hold, because there'll be a number for people to call, and that'll be published through the internet. It'll be published all over. We're going to do some marketing stuff too. But I'll give you an example. I was in my office yesterday, and I get a phone call, from the city of somebody from the city of Martinsburg that somebody came in, and they were looking for a meeting list and didn't know what to tell them, and they pulled it off the internet. Unfortunately, the internet wasn't all up to speed. So the woman then called me because they said, we gave them your number. She called me, and she said, I have someone here. He's a veteran from Colorado, and he was having some issues, and he's trying to find some place to go. And I said, well, where are you at? And she told me where she was at. I said, well, I could be there in 3 minutes. And I went down there and met with this individual, and he was in the panic mode. I know that look. That look was, I'm going to go drink, I'm going to go use. And I said, talked to him for a couple minutes. I said, listen, there is a meeting, and it doesn't start till 5:30. It's 3 o'clock now. I said, why don't you, if you don't mind, why don't you get in the car with me, and we'll go, we'll talk, and we'll walk around. And we did that, and we hung out, and you could just see how he started to calm down a bit, and then lo and behold, I dropped him off where he needed to be at that time, and the process is now started. I introduced him to some people, so that's key. That is key. We can, and I need to ask the doctor a question if I could. I was at a function, an educational process for me yesterday, and someone brought up, it was one of the daycares in southern West Virginia, or I'm sorry, not daycare.
Report center.
Day report center. And there was reports that there were some individuals being revived 5 or 6 times, mm-hmm. different times, not at the same time, different times, the same individual on the Narcan, and that concerns me. I mean, it's great that we have it, but how many times are we going to give an individual this kind of opportunity? One is because there's nobody there to say, hey, listen, we need to take you here or do something, but we can't do that because of people's rights and stuff.
Well, one solution to being revived too many times is just not revive them. That's actually...
Oh, boy, I wonder how that would go over.
No, that's actually been proposed to me to my face.
Well, you know what, I don't want to get into that type of discussion, but there has to be, you say, let's inundate Martinsburg, let's inundate Hagerstown, whatever,
that's right.
Narcan. That's my concern would be that, yes, we do that, but then the addict themselves, they know it's there, you know, and that's going to be still, one will use while the other one watches.
Well, there's actually data on that. They've studied that.
Well, I'd love to see that.
Yes, and the data shows that's not true.
Okay, if you could send
me that. I'll find that because it's an important point.
Well,
Narcan programs don't increase the amount of people using drugs. All it does, look at Narcan as something like CPR. Okay, CPR does not treat heart disease. CPR does not make your heart better. In fact, usually after CPR, your heart's a bit worse. CPR is not a treatment of heart disease.
Well,
Narcan is much more effective than CPR in getting the person back to life again.
You're absolutely right. Okay. But the concern is that you know how many times do we
if our
resources are going out there and how many times, because I'm hearing this from our EMS guys. He said, hey, you know what? In the last month, I've revived the same guy 3 times.
Mm-hmm. So the solution isn't how many times we're going to revive them. The solution has got to be what we're going to do after they're revived. Offer them something?
You're right.
Okay? For example, a person who's been revived in the emergency room or goes through the emergency room, is that person given a Narcan kit to go home with? This would be useful. Okay? People leaving jail. The incidence of death from overdose is 5 times higher within 2 weeks after you leave jail. Why aren't people in jail given Narcan kits? Now, this kind of goes further to the question you're just asking, what we're going to do with all these people that we revive. I'm kind of glad we can ask the question because we have revived those people. However, yes, where do these people go after they're revived? Okay. Now, one of the problems with Narcan is it puts the person into withdrawal. That's how it works. These individuals they want to go again because of the medicine we just gave them. This is a problem. But the solution surely has got to be to treat these people as if they have a serious medical condition, just like the person with CPR and the heart attack. Treat them as if they have a serious medical treatment problem which needs serious attention. It may not be medical, in, i.e. a prescription, but something which gets their attention. For instance, jail. Now, here we have a jail. We have people in jail for like 2 years. Are they offered any treatment opportunities in jail at all?
Not that I know of.
Would it be useful for at least give them a shot of Vivitrol before they leave jail? So for the next month, they have no interest in using narcotics. In that period of time, you might be able to get their attention and get them into a treatment program. You might be able to, because Vivitrol is not Suboxone. It's not a narcotic. And one shot, and other places in West Virginia, the jails are doing this. So in that month, where can we send them?
what clinic can take care of them? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think the same thing is what we talked about here. I mean, there needs to be processes put in place within the jail systems that reaches out to those
types and the emergency room.
Yeah. Yes,
why are right. people released from the emergency room without an appointment the next day with a clinician?
Or even, well, you know why? Because the most of the time, 99% of the time, the people just want to get the heck out of there. And because of HIPAA laws and all that, they're not able to supply that information to people like ourselves. That's my understanding.
I would also say that the staff has no place to send them.
That's right.
You know, or that's if they make an appointment at the clinic, it's 6 months, which in 6 months, according to this trend you cited, that's 100 people dead.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy.
How expensive is the Narcan, and is it available only by prescription?
Well, it's available. Hopefully, it ought to be sold by the peanut butter in Walmart, but nevertheless.
The law, legislation just passed that that's going to probably be sold over the counter.
Well, it's not really over the counter. The pharmacy, the Board of Pharmacy is asking us to be very careful with that phrase, but pharmacists can dispense it. Pharmacists can dispense it. They're actually writing their own prescription. They have a standing order prescription.
Okay.
So, because pharmacists are licensed healthcare providers. Any licensed healthcare provider in the state can sign the prescription.
Okay.
Unfortunately, in the Eastern Panhandle, I'm the only one doing it that I know of for the take-home program, but any licensed provider, including pharmacists. So the pharmacist, by a law that is slowly working its way through, but it may actually make it through this session, any pharmacist can provide this and provide the training. And this would be fantastic for me because I'm spending so much money on these kits and so much money, time, and effort. It would be great if the pharmacist can do this, but it still begs the question which you've raised, then what do we do next? And that I don't have an answer to. That's, I'm hoping you'd have the answer for that.
well, that's the answer is that we're talking about it here. You know, we need to find some different ways to get the arm out there to recovery, get the people into some type of aftercare, whether it be after coming off of the Narcan, whether it be after an overdose, whatever it might be. But, you know, those processes right now are not in place. And legally, I don't know what can or cannot be done. I'm not a legal guy, but to your point there, my question to you is the kits, are they coming out? Is that coming out of your own pocket?
So far.
Well, my suggestion to you would be is there's some great organizations out there on social media that Bikers Against Heroin, you have the Berkeley County Epidemic and Awareness Groups that are putting together fundraisers. That might be something for them to get behind.
Mm.
To be able to help fund something like that, and I'd be more than happy to share that with those leaders. Or you and I are meeting again.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
Actually, I have to say that my when I first came down here, I thought there was going to be all kinds of back and forth bickering because of how you feel and how I feel. That's not happening because I think I've been a little bit open minded more over the last 6 or 8 months and. What you're doing is some great stuff with the Narcan and the education process, and also I like how you feel about the needle exchange. I too believe something like that should be in place. We don't have what we are missing is we don't have the law enforcement individuals involved in the Narcan, which is something that we have to work on.
That's being changed. I learned three or four days ago that. Berkeley County Sheriff is now going to be training.
In some cases, and I'm not going to get into any kind of political speaking here, but in some cases, there's an election process up here in Berkeley County for state, local, and state, county, and city municipalities, and people really need to take a look at who's actually running and what they stand for, because you're talking the next 4 to 6 years. Of things. If you take a look at the makeup of the city, had an issue that they voted against Baltimore Street as far as the zoning issue, and you had, but the vote was 4-3, right? But if you take a look at who registered to vote or who registered to run for the city, 3 out of those 4 have opponents.
Mm-hmm.
3 out of those 4 that voted against it have opponents. So it's important that we go take a look at those people and see what they stand for, because the ones that voted for it don't have opponents. That tells me something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fairness, Kevin, I do know one of those who voted against it had other reasons, other than not a a disbelief in treatment for addiction. The concern was
I don't think any of them had anything against treatment for addiction.
Right.
It was a political. It was a political theme, no matter who it was.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to agree to disagree on that, because I thought this councilman expressed some real concerns about the efficacy of the facility that was being proposed for that site.
But we need to
push forward. That's for sure. Yep. You know, John, I want you to express Joe. How much more time do we have?
We're okay.
I want you to express a little the concern you've expressed to me about the prejudice against people with addiction when they walk into the pharmacies in Berkeley County.
Well, I can give two sides of that. One, the pharmacies are doing a fantastic job supporting my patients. I sent them all Christmas letters last year because I'm so impressed. These are difficult patients to work with sometimes. These are patients who, for some glitch in the paperwork, some glitch in something, they're not going to get their medicine that day, and they take it out on the pharmacy. And this is awkward, and this is difficult. And I have to give the pharmacies a lot of credit for being able to put up with this. They don't give me that much trouble. I'm the one writing the prescription, okay? They treat me really nicely, and I know that the pharmacies don't always have it that way. However, there is sometimes... not from the pharmacists themselves, which is quite interesting, but sometimes at the lower down the food chain there in the pharmacy, there is a certain amount of general hostility. If they're there for a certain medication, they sense a considerable amount of unpleasant behavior. And it isn't all pharmacies. It's some of them. And I usually call up the pharmacist. I speak to the pharmacist. And they uniformly have been apologetic and say, no, that's inappropriate. We will not tolerate that. So, it's plus and minus. It's good and bad, usually good, but sometimes it hasn't worked out very well.
I thought you had expressed that there was some pushback about distributing clean needles because of this notion that was going to promote substance abuse.
I'm sorry. I should have. I realized what you were talking about there now. Yes. It's been quite remarkable. There is a notion from many of the pharmacists, no, not the pharmacists, the pharmacies. The pharmacists usually are very much in line with the way I'm thinking on this, that if they give people more needles and syringes more easily, they'll use more heroin. Sorry, that's not the way the disease works. They will inject with any needle and syringe they can get. If they have to pick it up on the street, they will. I'm not making that up. I've had patients tell that to me. So the issue is not will they inject or not. The issue is will they use a clean needle or not. That's the only issue involved here. Some of the pharmacists have expressed considerable dismay seeing dirty needles laying around on the street. Okay, I find that pretty disgusting myself. Okay, that's okay. I understand that. However, at least the two pharmacies that I know of which were selling needles and syringes, now it's only one, insisted the patients buy a needle sharps container, one of these big red containers for dirty needles and syringes. They would not sell the needles and syringes to the patient unless they bought a sharps container. It was really working pretty well. We all as a community are better off if people who are injecting illicit drugs, heroin, are using clean needles. We're all in a healthier state.
I agree.
There's this disaster that occurred in Indiana recently when the HIV rate shot through the ceiling. Okay? It was all from dirty needles. They introduced a needle exchange program, which, of course, lots of grants and lots of money, and da-da-da. But they started getting needle exchange program, and the incidence dropped precipitously. It was an amazing small study. It was for the isolated community. This is a dangerous situation. My patients with their hepatitis C problem is horrific, and we can do better than this. So
you're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown. I did want to go back to the Zarkand question. Narcan. What is the, pardon?
Narcan.
Narcan, I'm sorry. What is the cost per dose?
Good
and,
question.
And is the is it a single dose adequate in every situation?
Every prescription has two doses. It's almost impossible to write a prescription for one dose. It just doesn't happen. So it's always one dose, wait 3 minutes. If they're not better, give a second dose. So it's always two doses. Cost is an interesting number with pharmaceuticals, okay? How much does the insurance company pay? How much does it pay for cash, et cetera, okay? Right. Medicaid covers this completely. There's no charge, and most insurance companies cover it completely. When I got my prescription filled, it was a $6 copay from Blue Cross Blue Shield. Some copays are as high as $35 for the two doses. Okay, and that's the highest I've heard. So it's all over the place. Typical of any medicines like this, it's just all over the place.
But the thing is, not everybody has a prescription for it. I mean, so if you wanted, if you and I wanted to go in and get some Narcan, we can get it, but we just
no, you can't get it. You need a prescription.
I've heard stories from anywhere between $20 to $50.
Actually, it's $75
locally
cash. $75, that is at the pharmacy.
That their insurance didn't cover.
Yeah, or the insurance doesn't cover, the copay, right.
Right.
Okay. The actual cost that the pharmacy pays for it is up to
$75. A lot of people aren't going to have the insurance. Does Medicaid pay for it?
Yes, Medicaid pays completely. There's no copay. Okay. So that's a good deal. However, you do need a prescription by the state law because it's a prescribed drug, which could change one of these days. We hope so, but could change. But you can't just walk in and ask for it. Okay. Yeah, I thought
you said the pharmacist had authority to write that prescription.
No. Well, the pharmacy had the authority to, but they won't at this point in time. But they're writing a law where the pharmacist can write and dispense at the same time and do the training. There has to be a training component there somewhere.
Okay. That's happening in the legislative session right now,
yeah.
Charles. So that's out there if you want to research it.
The governor's pushing this through, and it's a pretty good bill. I really think it's doing very well. My deal is, I don't know how many pharmacies we have in this Eastern Panhandle. I know how many doctors we have prescribing take-home naloxone. That's one. The pharmacist's role could be just huge here. It'd be very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all very much. I do want to ask one more question, and what is the meeting that's coming up, and is this important to moving forward in this area?
Well, I can tell you, as I know it, the doctor didn't set this up. It was somebody else that set it up. And it's basically going to have the same conversation we're probably having here today. It's going to give you a little bit, I'm going to show him some of the goals and initiatives. It's not something that I can share until I get it to the council, but I can show him that day. And you know, we can bat around a few other ideas. And I think I have to say thank you, Joe, for putting this together. I told you I was apprehensive when you called me and told me you were going to have some other people on. I think today was a very good day, at least for myself, to get some open conversation on what's going on here. I do want to clear up one thing. Ken Collins and I love you. but I didn't want to get into any kind of political thing here, but my point is that there are some election processes coming up. Keep in mind that the governor is going out, so we got to hope that the governor that's coming in is going to be as nice to what this governor has been for this problem.
He's done a great job.
He's done a wonderful job. Yeah. I've been fortunate to have plenty of conversations with him.
Okay. Any closing remarks, anyone?
Yep.
Okay. I thank you all very much. It concludes the show, Seven Generations. Thank you all for listening in. Be back in a couple of weeks. Do it again. Thank you all.